Jawhara al-Sharuk and Al-Jala Towers. The latter housed offices of media outlets including Al Jazeera English and the Associated Press. The four towers also included residences and numerous businesses, including doctors' offices. Why no deaths were reported for the attacks on the four towers, unlike other Israeli regime military strikes in May? The destruction appeared consistent with the use of munitions with large, high-explosive warheads, said HRW. These explosive weapons produced wide-area effects, resulting in complete destruction or serious damage to each of the towers and damage to surrounding areas, including to homes, businesses, and infrastructure. In addition to displacing thousands, the attacks destroyed civilian property worth millions of U.S. dollars, the human rights group said. 45-year-old computer engineer Nihad Abdullatif Taha, who had a programming and digital marketing company, Portals, described the devastation to HRW. I had 36 employees and we were renting two apartments, 360 square meters with furniture, offices, meeting rooms, surveillance cameras. All of this is gone, he said, adding, in addition to very important documents, all the company's papers are gone, including stamps, and the employees' contracts are gone. The new analysis also pushes back on the Israeli regime's military contention that groups use parts of any of the buildings for military research and development or military intelligence purposes. Human Rights Watch found no evidence that members of Palestinian groups involved in military operations had a current or long-term presence in any of the towers at a time they were attacked, the group said. What's more, even if there were such a presence, the attacks appear to cause foreseeably disproportionate harm to civilian property. Ware, in his statement, said, reconstruction for Palestinians requires not just ending Israeli regime's repeated and ongoing attacks on Gaza, but termination of the blockade. Throughout the May hostilities, unlawful Israeli strikes not only killed many civilians, but also destroyed high-rise towers, wiping out scores of businesses and homes, upending the lives of thousands of Palestinians, Ware said. Donor funding alone will not rebuild Gaza, he said, adding, the crushing closure of the Gaza Strip needs to end, along with the impunity that fuels ongoing serious abuses. The Zionist regime's May attacks on Gaza has also come under the scrutiny of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, who said that they may constitute war crimes. Despite Israelis' claims that many of these buildings were hosting armed groups or being used for military purposes, she said in May, we have not seen evidence in this regard.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light. And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ.
Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and my dear guest speakers or guests in this program are Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Welcome. And Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum salam, glad to be here.
Well, let's, you know, in this program, focus on the movie God's Not Dead, number 3 in its sequel. It is also called A Light in Darkness, right? Well, before we start talking about it, let me just give a very overview that in this movie, the Reverend Dave Hill faces an unexpected setback when his church burns down. That's going to prompt the officials at the adjoining university to try to expel his congregation off the campus. Legal battles then take place because of this between him and his longtime friend, the president of the university, though. He seeks help from his estranged brother, a big city lawyer, and an atheist, by the way, in order to rebuild his church. Before we continue this program, let's take a listen to a part of this movie.
Sometimes all it takes is a spark. The spark becomes a flame. And if that flame spreads, it transforms everything around it.
These years, this church has been here. Now it's the crime scene.
What's gonna happen when I find him?
Put him away, I hope, for a long time.
The church has brought nothing but controversy to the school for years.
What's the church doing on a state campus in the first place?
This was my father's church.
That was part or a trailer of the movie God's Not Dead, number 3, or A Light in Darkness. In this program, Viewpoint. Brother Hussein, did you like this movie? Directed by Michael Mason.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Actually, it wasn't bad. I felt like it was pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
It had a strong message. And I liked how the characters were motivated. So, you know, each person had their own beliefs and they were really, really fighting for it.
All right. How about you, Sayyid Abdullah? Did you like the movie? How did you like the movie? One of the producers is the same as the major character in the movie. I mean, David A.R. White.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. No, I didn't enjoy it at all. It was just, if you watch the first two,
yes,
it's just the same thing all over. It's just a different, just a different graphics and different location. As far as the story goes, it's exactly the same as the previous two. They're just trying to push the agenda. God is not dead in their mm-hmm. way, obviously.
Yes.
But it's not enjoyable. It's just boring for me. It just mm-hmm. it doesn't have a story. It's just not something that you would, you know, get something back from.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion, of course.
I see. The box office was 7.4 million, by the way, mm-hmm. right? And about the reviews, it received mixed reviews, by the way, right? And Rotten Tomatoes, for example, gave the approving rate of 10%, an average rating of 3.65 out of 10, of course, right?
Which were the actors themselves.
Yes. And the cinema score, for example, gave an average score of A-. On an A plus to F scale, by the way. Well, we also have the, the other rating by Metacritic. It was the average score of 33 out of 100. Brother Hussein, I'm going to ask you about the name of this movie. Does it ring a bell?
No, it doesn't. But you know, I guess it makes sense. It feels like, you know, the type of thing that you would say to a person who's lost, you know, who's you know, questioning their faith.
Mm-hmm.
You tell them, hey, God's not dead, you know? Don't lose hope.
Right.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take a listen to another part of this movie, and then we'll be back coming with the questions.
Reverend, what do you have to say about the police today?
I am grateful to the court that they recognized that this mandate was unconstitutional. I think this is more of a human rights issue. It's about our right to see truth and to share that truth with others.
But considering your church is associated with a public university, how do you define truth exactly?
Truth is a person. Person of Jesus Christ. It's the one truth of all others.
What do you have to say to the people here who are calling him?
Jesus Christ is the one truth? Really? This guy just can't help himself, can he?
This guy is a pastor who was jailed for his beliefs.
What if it was a Jewish rabbi that said there was one truth? Or a Muslim imam?
They have that right. Freedom of worship.
In places of worship. But Headley is a state university.
See, and that's the question, y'all. What's a church doing on a state campus in the first place?
We're seeing more and more protests around the
students are actually calling for the removal of St. James from Headley campus.
As the battle rages on in hope.
A historic landmark that has served this community for over a century. And now they want the church gone. This is what our country has come to.
That was a part of the movie Sayyid Abdullah, and it's talking about the media and how the media can twist and turn things, right? Mm. Especially I'm talking about the beginning part.
Yeah.
All right. What is the role of the media in relation to a lot of things, including religion?
Well, I mean, it is not a secret that the media today plays a massive role in brainwashing the masses,
mm-hmm.
where people these days, they can't be bothered learning mm-hmm. themselves or reading themselves or researching themselves. So
yes.
sometimes you send a clip that is 30 seconds in length.
Mm-hmm.
It is enough to change someone's perspective or someone's ideology about something.
Yes.
That's how effective the media is these days. So people rely heavily on media. Therefore, the role of the media cannot be overlooked. So when it comes to, for example, religious matters,
mm-hmm.
You have to take into consideration that most of the media outlets are owned by people who are not religious themselves,
mm-hmm.
Be it atheists or be it even, let's assume, Jews or Christians who don't really care much about religion. So they're... focus is always negative towards religion. So they're trying to put religion down in any way, form, or shape possible. So the media is always targeting religion. Therefore, it's not religion-friendly
mm-hmm.
kind of media.
But when we're talking about media, we also include the movie industry,
mm.
all right? And this movie is a kind of Christian drama film,
mm-hmm.
right? It's an American movie, but it's a Christian film.
That's right.
So... media can be at the service of religion too.
No, that's what we're saying is the media could be the service of anyone. Anyone could use the media if you have the tools, if you have the money, if you have the equipment,
mm-hmm.
you can make films. So the same guy, David White himself, he established his own movie production based on Christianity because he's a Christian guy himself and
yes.
he preaches Christianity and stuff. So he started it. The idea is. You have many media outlets, but which one is, for example, most known or most that has most effect on people? So I could have my own media production. How many people are going to watch my movies? For example, the movie itself, God is Not Dead. How many people watched it? Because the minute people watch God in the title, like, I'll pass, thank you. You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? So
yes.
they would want something else. So let's say Hollywood itself is overtaking the entire world. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
How many of Hollywood movies are religious-based
yeah,
or with right. religion? The majority of the movies, I would say 99.9 of the movies are against religion.
Yeah.
Which is the...
they're secular.
Yeah. So so the mass media is against religion. Even though
mm-hmm.
there are outlets, there are productions of religious movies, but people just find them boring and people just don't get in touch with them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have like a fan base.
Mm-hmm. I see. Brother Hussein, do you agree with Sayyid Abdullah? You know, we see that whenever the word, because he was referring to the fact that when you sometimes see or hear, for example, the word which are religion related, such as God or something like this,
yeah,
like in the title of this movie, then he says, thank you, I'll pass, right?
Yeah, people are kind of sensitive to, controversial matters like this, because in this day and age where everyone's like a liberal and, atheism is being pushed over,
mm-hmm.
very, very massive, mm-hmm. On a very massive scale.
Yes.
People get sensitive to stuff like this. And, they mm-hmm. find it, this is kind of boring. I'm probably not going to agree with some of the stuff that
mm-hmm.
The movie's going to talk about. So why would I watch it,
I see.
So does that answer your question?
Yeah, kind of. Well, but on the other hand, some other people become more sensitive to these controversial issues. Like when something comes up like this, like anything religious, anything godly,
yeah,
then they would like prick up their ears and start like listening and pay attention to those things.
Yeah, I feel like it's like a two-sided coin. It can either help or it can, make a person uncomfortable. If a person's like, trying to find a fun and,
mm-hmm.
Interesting way to establish or, confirm their faith,
mm-hmm.
then I guess they can watch the movie,
yes.
like especially if they're Christians. For a person who's like questioning or, has like that bad taste,
I see.
From previous events that happened in their own personal
mm-hmm.
life, then they might not really
I see.
Be
okay.
interested.
Before me asking you guys another question, let's take another listen to another part of this movie, God's Not Dead, Light in Darkness.
The theory is our reality collided with a parallel reality.
Right, where Kit Kat has no hyphen and Curious George has no tail.
Okay. Look, it's science, okay? Quantum physics.
Quantum
Look it up.
Physics.
You guys seriously not hear how ridiculous you sound?
Okay, but God had himself a human son who could walk on water and multiply fish, and that's not ridiculous? So yeah, given the choice, I'm taking the Kit Kat theory. And if we get lucky, maybe we'll collide with the reality where our school isn't poisoned by Reverend Dave and his one truth.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. Well, we're talking about or discussing the movie and criticizing it, the movie God's Not Dead 3 or A Light in Darkness. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, in the earlier part of the movie, we see that these kids, in fact, start arguing about religion,
mm-hmm.
and they base it on scientific facts, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's kind of typical of the atheist, usually, or those people who are somehow inclined toward atheism. They turn to or resort to science and scientific facts,
mm-hmm.
all right? Well, in order to mock sometimes religion. Sometimes they call religion superstition,
mm-hmm.
right? What do you make of this? Why is it like this always?
Why it's simple. When you talk about religion, religion means responsibilities and belief in things that cannot be seen.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one camp. On the other hand, there are people who don't like to have responsibilities themselves.
Yes.
They want to live a free life because they look at religion as something that will just limit their
freedom. So
their freedom or their, whatever they want to do
yeah.
is limited through religion. So they say, well, we don't need that. And then they have to justify it because, see, a Christian himself, he would bring ideas forward and ideologies forward to prove the existence of God and we have to, follow the laws of God. On the other hand, if you're an atheist or a person who doesn't want to uphold the laws of God, for example, you
yes.
just want to do whatever you want,
mm-hmm.
you have no other result but to convince yourself that these laws are not there, therefore such a God is not there. How do you prove that?
Mm-hmm.
You prove it through science.
Yes.
You say, well, science proves to me everything. Science explains to me how the universe was created. Science proves to me how this world was created, how everything works. So where do you put God in here? Therefore, God and religion is superstition, right?
Yes.
Because he's trying to tell me God created the world in 6 days and then he sat on the throne and he relaxed. And then he said, let there be light and all this mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just superstition. Where science tells me, no, there was Big Bang. There were, you know, the universe expanded and things created. And they give and you scientific. So
the evolution comes.
Exactly. Yeah. So the scientist or the person who uses science, in fact, all he's trying to do is justify for himself why he should be free.
Yeah.
On the other hand, a Christian or someone who believes in God wants to do that. So you always have that camp between believers and unbelievers. Yes. So even sometimes you have those who believe in something out there, but what they call God or not, but they still you know, rely on science to explain and to keep themselves that conviction.
Okay, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we are really out of time for this program. Viewpoint, the movie critique program. We were discussing the movie or criticizing the movie God's Not Dead, number 3, or Light in Darkness. We'll be back and follow us same time, same day, in fact, next week to continue our criticism of the movie God's Not Dead, number 3, Light in Darkness. I'm Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and my dear guests in this program were Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
How do we actually know that our values are any more valid than anyone else's?
God called me to fight.
God calls you, you call me.
His brother is a lawyer. Are you kidding me?
What you're doing, it's against the law.
We're wasting our time here.
We cannot respond to hate with more hate.
Is it true?
I just don't see God's mercy here, especially not from Pastor Dave.
He's human, Keaton.
He's supposed to be a man of God.
What am I doing wrong? You don't get to play innocent.
You did this!
The whole world knows what the church is against, but it's getting harder and harder to know what it's for.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The United States was involved in Afghanistan long before 9/11, paving the way for its own defeat. The fall of Kabul, like the fall of Saigon in April 1975, demonstrates again that imperialism often doesn't work, even to meet the goals of the imperial power. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Zoltan Grossman, writer. This article is published under the heading, 5 Ways U.S. Created and Prolonged Afghan Crisis. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Media coverage of the Taliban takeover of Kabul would lead most Americans to believe that U.S. involvement in Afghanistan began after 9/11 with the invasion launched to topple the previous Taliban government. But Afghanistan has been at war continuously for 42 years, and the Pentagon has been involved every step of the way under both Republican and Democratic administrations. Far from standing in the way of a takeover, a series of U.S. interventions helped create, arm, and facilitate the Mujahideen that took the country away from more secular direction it had been taken in 1960s to 1980s. What Afghanistan has in common with both Vietnam and Iraq is its long history of resistance to foreign occupiers, long before the Americans ever arrived. This resistance to foreign rule is the only factor that has united Afghanistan's diverse ethnic and sectarian groups in the past two centuries. The fall of Kabul recently, like the fall of Saigon in April 1975, demonstrates again that imperialism often doesn't work, even to meet the goals of the imperial power. Imperial forces get lured into battle and then get bogged down in a quagmire they cannot win. British troops barely escaped with their lives from three colonial wars in Afghanistan before their global empire finally collapsed. The Russians withdrew in defeat in 1989, only a few years before the Soviet Union and its Afghan allies collapsed. And now the Americans have followed down the same path of imperial hubris and defeat. After the Reagan administration took power in 1981, it openly supplied weapons, including Stinger missiles, to the Mujahideen, who at that time were also assisted by a Saudi engineer named Osama bin Laden. American popular culture lionized the Mujahideen as anti-communist freedom fighters in movies such as Rambo III and Red Dawn. By openly backing the Mujahideen against the Soviets, the Carter and Reagan administrations helped set into motion a cycle of violence that has since claimed more than 2 million Afghan lives and thousands of American lives and helped to create the Taliban. U.S.-backed rulers restricted women's rights before the Taliban existed. The first fall of Kabul to insurgents in 1992 marked the end of Afghanistan's secular era. The first severe restrictions on women's rights were instituted then not by the Taliban, which had not been yet formed, but by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen, who seized power from the pro-Soviet government. The Pentagon and CIA armed and financed the same vicious militia warlords who brought fundamentalist misogyny to Kabul in the first place. According to Amnesty International, the rape of women by armed guards appeared to be condoned by leaders as a method of intimidating vanquished populations and of rewarding soldiers. And Mujahideen were reported to have stopped women from working outside their homes or from attending health and family planning courses. Educated women, particularly working in the fields of education and welfare, were repeatedly threatened. The U.S. war has been a humanitarian catastrophe. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S.-backed Afghan government has killed many civilians in air strikes and still failed to prosecute senior officials responsible for sexual assault, torture, and killing civilians. Taliban fighters continue to abuse human rights and commit atrocities in their areas of control, which steadily grew throughout the years despite the 300,000-strong Afghan National Army, U.S. airstrikes, and more than $1 trillion spent on military aid and nation-building assistance. In its 20th century wars, the Pentagon always planned to leave behind Afghan and Iraqi proxy forces that would take up the fight, much as it tried to do through Vietnamization in 1973-75, and as Moscow tried to do just as unsuccessfully in Afghanistan in 1989-92. The third fall of Kabul, like the fall of Saigon, occurred in 2021 because the U.S.-backed army fell apart. A puppet government that is denied armed foreign backing can expire much like a terminal patient taken off of life support. As both Brzezinski and Bin Laden understood, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires, where they could most effectively trap and defeat their foes. Propping up colonial puppet regimes only highlights their indebtedness of foreign masters and helps legitimize and strengthen insurgencies rather than weaken them. Bombing civilians and ignoring the suffering of the poor only drives them into the hands of the insurgents. As in other regions of Asia and Africa, fundamentalism and foreign occupation are two sides of the same coin. They reinforce each other, feed off each other, and need each other. But two wrongs don't make a right.
Today. As the Taliban return to power in Afghanistan like never before, Iran adapts its stance by accepting them, but with a mindful eye. Iran's approach towards Afghanistan's turmoil will be our study of the day. Recent developments in Afghanistan have emerged over a mosaic social and political infrastructure. Before anything, Iran calls for inter-Afghan relations and participation by all political factions, all building tiles, in solving their country's many problems. But where called upon, this country will help. The question is how. For more, stay with me, Leila Faromarzi, on Iran Today. And in what capacity, actually? For some, help means taking up arms or sending in military consultants. And those skeptical of the Taliban ask why Iran is not taking action against the Taliban, because the Taliban threatened to attack Iran up to 20 years ago. Iran, they say, was the most advanced regional force in destroying Daesh. So how did it not take action against the Taliban, as though the life of the people of Afghanistan is less worthy than the lives of the people of Iraq and Syria? Mr. Zohraband was ambassador to Afghanistan and Italy. He visited Press TV studios to give us a concise, comprehensive interview.
Some point to Iran's presence in Syria and Iraq and say, why not Afghanistan? Well, the thing is, the Afghan government hasn't asked for our presence, right? I mean, if we just turn up there, we're acting like Americans.
The nature of our presence in Iraq and Syria is such that the governments of those countries saw some alignment in the threats and opportunities for themselves and us. And that's why we went there, by governmental demand. The result was also positive, meaning that if any of the countries were left alone, maybe the political maps would have had to be redrawn. Our stance regarding Iraq has been different. The former Afghan government never asked us for assistance or cooperation. That's why we maintained the same relations with Afghanistan as we did with some of our neighbors.
In recent years, Iran has not provided arms or financial assistance to the parties involved in Afghanistan so as not to be accused of defending one side.
Indeed, Iran tends not to enter militarily or send consultants into a country without the request of the legitimate government of that country. And so, according to the strategy, it will not enter Afghanistan at this stage either.
On July the 7th, Iran hosted talks between Taliban and Afghan government representatives in its capital city, Tehran. The Rouhani foreign minister, Javad Zarif, used the meeting to celebrate the U.S. departure from Afghanistan, whilst warning that continuing clashes between Taliban fighters and the Afghan government would be costly. The U.S. military exit from Afghanistan was due to be completed by August the 31st. Which is now to be extended. In the meantime, Iranian policymakers are strategizing about their future approach toward Afghanistan. This is a far cry from how things were 20 years ago and more. The attack on the Iranian consulate by the Taliban and the killing of Iranian diplomats was the culmination of hostilities at the time. The Taliban claimed that this was the case. Iran defended its anti-Taliban actions at the time, but even then refused to enter the country. Maulavi Khairullah, a Taliban political office member, did a face-to-face with Press TV. Here's a little of what he said. Mr. Zarei is an analyst and former diplomat who draws on background in looking at matters current. Let's hear him out.
We reached an agreement based on old agreements, which could go back 100 years, over the Helmand River waters. But we haven't been able to use the water for the past 20 years. This has had a negative impact on the economy of Sistan and Balochistan and South Khorasan provinces. To solve the issue, we need to engage in negotiations. There are other instances, like economic ties. We have $3.6 billion worth of currency transactions with Afghanistan. This can reach a $10 billion mark in a couple of years, which would both benefit the people of Afghanistan and the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Iran first needs security in Afghanistan, and it looks to, hopes for, the peaceful means to this. That's all Afghan factions reaching an understanding among themselves. On Sunday, August the 15th, after Kabul was taken by the Taliban, the then Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif welcomed the formation of a coordination council. That's remembered as Iran's first major reaction. We hope that it can lead to dialogue and a peaceful transition in Afghanistan, Zarif tweeted, as violence, war, and occupation never solve problems. The slightest insecurity equals the Afghans rushing to Iran. In fact, Iran suffers the most from any insecurity in Afghanistan compared to other countries.
How do you evaluate Iran's stance toward Afghanistan? Has it jumped ship, or is it naturally acting in favor of its own national interests?
Today, as the developments in Afghanistan show that the former government is gone and that the Taliban is taking over the country, we will continue to use our 20-year-long relations with the Taliban to stabilize the security and political situation of Afghanistan. This is both to the benefit of the Afghan nation and in line with the national interests of Iran.
The Taliban have their own incentives for relations with Iran. They would not want to risk alienating this country. In short, conflict with Iran is bad for business. The Iran-Afghanistan border includes several lucrative trade routes. And beyond differences, both Iran and the Taliban share an ideological antipathy towards the United States and the West, largely speaking.
Afghanistan ki di khalak rozili wa ba Afghanistan ki da amniyat ra wasalai su aw ne hum da su khuda imarat aw lan ba yaqi kum taqaddum pida klai su jang di baghair da din che khasara wo se dwar tara pot is fayda pro murata banas kisi ke bakhana e jagah dakhil mesha sahib khana me jang ta wo ki zinda masha chala ke bigana bakhana is amada agar baz me gardan hamu masala hamu ne scenario ki 20 sal guzasht hamu takrar mesha wa na pe jina pe na mera sana ba ma mera.
For Iran, the benefits of a good Tehran-New Taliban ties are less obvious. Iran did also have excellent contacts and significant influence, however, with Afghanistan's Hamid Karzai and Ashraf Ghani governments.
Yes, some people are asking in Iran why we didn't strongly support the democratic government of former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. They demand that we endanger the status of the Islamic Republic to throw our weight behind a government that doesn't have any roots, powers, legitimacy, or popularity. It was called a democratic government, but I don't know how it could be regarded as such. Only 1.8 million people participated in the Afghan elections 2 years ago. This is while over 20 million voters have been eligible to cast their ballots in the 40 million strong nation. What type of democracy is that? And this so-called democratic government never showed any cooperation with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Over the past few years, they have been ignoring our rights to the Helmand River.
Looking at the Taliban's recent promises and governing doctrine, the group has rationalized with experience gained over the years. But its past does echo a cautionary tale. Thousands of Afghans are already heading to Iran for fear of a radical interpretation of Islam. For Iran's part, I asked if the Taliban, after convincing all sides of its inclusiveness and peaceful intentions, might not get ideas about reviving a greater Khorasan or sowing discord between Iran's southeastern Sistan-Baluchistan province and the rest of the country.
Well, when considering foreign policy, the future can't be foretold. Our situation with the Taliban is such that we have had relations and agreements. The Taliban maintain that they remain committed to their obligations and are carrying them out. For example, the Helmand River is now flowing inside Sistan and Balochistan plains. They are saying they are committed. Therefore, there is no indication that the Taliban will turn into a security issue in the future. Hypothetically, if this is the case, we'll decide our next steps then. We are not a weak country. We can repel any aggression.
For a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review with Sarah on Afghan refugees to Iran, past and potential, and on what's positive about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Hello and welcome to another edition with me, Sarah Adema. Today we will look into some reviews regarding the Taliban's return to power and Iran's say in this matter. Our first piece of news comes from the Middle East Eye that begins with the headline, Afghanistan says Iranians look on with apprehension at crisis next door. Ever since the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan 42 years ago, Iranians have been living alongside Afghan refugees and immigrants, and many in the country see the fall of Kabul as yet another dark chapter in the neighboring country's contemporary history. But the recent crisis in Afghanistan has brought a renewed debate in Iran. Should the country keep its doors closed to refugees amid its fifth wave of the COVID-19 pandemic and an economy strained by years of U.S. sanctions, or should solidarity prevail? After the monarchy collapsed in Iran, which was replaced by an Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini ordered the opening of the borders of Afghan refugees. While many Afghans initially landed in Iran's eastern provinces near the border, many went on to settle across the country. However, not all Iranians share the same sentiment about a potential influx of new Afghan refugees, especially those who live in regions already home to many of the country's 3 million Afghan residents. Moving on to the next review that comes from the Organization for World Peace, it reads, Iran says U.S. defeat in Afghanistan offers chance for peace. Iran State TV quoted President Ebrahim Raisi as saying, America's military defeat and its withdrawal must become an opportunity to restore life, security, and durable peace in Afghanistan. He continued, Iran backs efforts to restore stability in Afghanistan, and as a neighboring and brother nation, Iran invites all groups in Afghanistan to reach a national agreement. Barring intervention, Afghanistan is poised to collapse under the wheel of Taliban rule or erupt into a violent civil war. Neither outcome bodes well for Afghanistan's neighbors nor Afghan civilians. It is incumbent upon Iran and Pakistan, two nations with significant investment in the stability of Afghanistan, to exert their influence and immediately initiate and facilitate peace talks between the Taliban and Afghanistan's remaining government. Both Iran and Pakistan have expressed that a power-sharing agreement is their ideal outcome for Afghanistan's future. Additionally, international organizations, including the North Atlantic Treaty Organizations and the United Nations, need to closely monitor Afghanistan for human rights abuses during this uncertain transition. Our final review from Tehran Times says, refugees seek asylum in Iran as Taliban takes over in Afghanistan. As former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran. Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their positions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country. Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. The Milag crossing point in Sistan-Balochistan province is one of the border crossings that has been the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks, disinfectants, food, and medicine. That's it for me in today's edition. And now, back to you, Leila.
The return of Afghan immigrants to their country is economically beneficial for Iran and even Afghanistan. These immigrants have been working and studying in this country for many years and are considered skilled workers now, beneficial for Afghanistan. And as for Iran, this country could lighten its population load, given its gasping economy further strangulated by U.S. sanctions and the corona pandemic. The pressure on healthcare, education, and subsidies is paramount. Afghan security is of paramount importance to Iran. How does this affect Iran's stance to inter-Afghan relations? And all Afghan factions governing their country, deciding for their country and solving its problems.
Our relationship with Afghanistan can impact our security. One example is the issue of immigrants. Others are drug-related problems, and the presence of Takfiri terrorists like Daesh and Al-Qaeda that have been affecting the world. The other issue is that every time Afghanistan is hit with a crisis, we'll see a rise in the numbers of asylum seekers. Our economic ties with Afghanistan have been affected. The Central Asian country imports 90% of the goods it needs. At the moment when unemployment is rampant and concerns are heightened, the economy is stalled. This has impacted Afghanistan's imports from Iran. These lead us to stay sensitive about the developments in the country.
Altogether, over 3 million Afghans are known to be living in Iran. According to government figures given in October 2020, on which consultations are ongoing, 800,000 refugees live in Iran. That is 780,000 Afghans and 20,000 Iraqis. But some 2 million undocumented Afghans and nearly 600,000 Afghan passport holders also live in Iran, with Iranian visas. Iran wants the withdrawal of extra-regional forces from Afghanistan because it believes that their presence is equal to the destruction of security.
The Americans had come to stay for at least 70 to 80 years, but why are they leaving now? Because they suffered a huge defeat. The Americans claim to have spent $2 trillion in the war, and at least 6,000 American soldiers were killed in the country, and the death toll was steadily rising. On the other hand, they did not create any logical rationale that would justify their stay for the world, so they withdrew with shame. What you refer to as the problem in Afghanistan wasn't caused by the U.S. withdrawal in the past 2 weeks. It was created by the U.S. military deployment to Afghanistan.
The problem is that after 20 years, the United States failed to achieve its goal of eliminating the Taliban. In practice, the Taliban were able to establish themselves as an ethnic and religious force to the extent that they effectively challenged the power of the central government and brought international powers to the negotiating table. Knowing this and seeing the U.S. defeat at the hands of indigenous Taliban forces, Iran decided to encourage inter-Afghan talks. In these negotiations, the Taliban agreed to recognize the rights of all ethnic and religious minorities if they won. It was the dissatisfaction of the Afghan people with the corruption and inefficiency of the U.S.-backed government that reduced their interest in the central government to almost zero. Corruption and so lack of development. Perhaps this was the reason for the Taliban's advancing into all districts almost uncontested.
The rapid advancements of the Taliban, which astonished the international community, including its neighbors, called for us to monitor the situation more closely. What is important for us is observing the kind of action Afghan society and people will take towards this development and how they will adapt themselves to it. As a country that has always stood by the Afghan people, we are monitoring the developments and the type of interaction of the Taliban with the people of Afghanistan and the structure that they are set to present in the political system of the country and see how the people will cooperate with them.
The central government of Afghanistan, with its catastrophic defeat, showed that 20 years of U.S. presence in the country had not been to build a strong system. The goal of the United States was simply to have a military presence in the country and perhaps to prevent it from becoming secure. Please comment on the necessity of American troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan given their corruptive nature, their corruptive influence.
On the first day, the Americans claimed that they were going to build a government and a nation in Afghanistan. Today, they say that their goal wasn't nation building. It's in a stark contrast to the position 20 years ago. They killed bin Laden. What else would have justified their presence there? That's why they're not telling the facts. The other point is that the Afghan army, which received $88 billion of US assistance, was so disorganized that the replacement of a few commanders led to its dissolution. This shows the Americans haven't even been successful in army building. Their withdrawal was similarly irresponsible. they could have devised a better plan for that and ask assistance from the neighboring countries to help with the power vacuum following their withdrawal. But that didn't happen.
UNHCR, the UN agency, for its part, urged the international community to step up immediate and sustained support to both Afghanistan and its neighbors in a spirit of responsibility and burden sharing. But it also appealed to the Iranian government to continue its tradition of hospitality in hosting Afghans fleeing conflicts and violence for over 40 years. To round up, whoever of the Afghans gets a majority vote, Iran, based on previous experiences, will, as it has done so far, call for the security of Afghanistan. Iran's anti-Taliban approach in the past was due to their threats against Iran. In fact, Iran has repeatedly warned that it will respond to any action against its interests. The Taliban have sought to accommodate Iran, also to expand their portfolio of diplomatic support beyond Pakistan. Last year, they appointed a Shia cleric from the Hazara community as a district governor in northern Afghanistan. The group have regularly condemned attacks on Shia mosques and districts of Afghanistan, presumably being carried out by the local branch of the terror group Daesh, known as ISIS in the world of the West. Daesh is hostile to both Iran and the Taliban. Most recently, the Taliban forcefully denied any link to a horrific attack on a girls' school in western Kabul, in a mostly Shia district. They also allowed Shias to commemorate Ashura in Mazar-e-Sharif. Ashura is the day the Shia leader Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, was martyred. Its anniversary was commemorated on the weekend just past. Sohail Shaheen is a Taliban spokesman. He says how the situation of women and girls should look under the Taliban.
The girls are going to their schools. There is no hurdle, and they are going to the schools. The teacher, female teacher, they have resumed their jobs. So we have no problem of women having access to education and to work. But only the Islamic hijab they observe. I think there is no question about women's rights, because we are giving rights to women all, to all women. But only it is about hijab. The Western countries say that, and this is part of their culture, that women can receive education without hijab. But we, as Islamic society and Muslim, we say women can receive or can have access to education with hijab.
Mr. Zarei says of the composition of Afghanistan,
from a religious standpoint, Afghanistan has a homogeneous nation, but from an ethnic point of view, it is not. The defining factor for the Taliban is their ethnicity rather than their faith. The Taliban are mostly representing Pashtuns in Afghan society. Therefore, a stable government can be formed in a country without proper regard for the other ethnicities, sharing the power. Ethnic tensions have been the cause of the conflict over the past 30 years since the Soviet occupation of the country ended. There have been no religious tensions, no tensions between Shias and Sunnis. If the Taliban want to establish a stable government in Afghanistan, they can do so without giving real shares to other ethnicities.
Ultimately, Iran is trying to respect the rights of different minorities as much as possible and to have a share in the power structure for each. Also, by proposing negotiations between the various groups, it is trying to encourage them to reach a peaceful agreement so that we do not see war and conflict in this country again. That's it for today. I thank you from the whole team. Bye all. Till next week.
In the limelight.
Western media outlets are proving once again that Afghan women's rights are only of interest to them when they can be used to prop up imperialism and the military-industrial complex. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julie Haller, writer. This article is published under the heading, Western media suddenly cares about Afghan women again after U.S. departure. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please.